Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord. I believe that we will win is one of the trendiest chants in sports today, made popular by fans of the U.S. men's national soccer team during last summer's World Cup in Brazil. Recently, the American Outlaws, quite possibly the largest and most vocal supporting group for the U.S. men's national soccer team, has faced criticism for the behavior of some of its members, which has included ugly displays of heavy drinking, nationalism, sexism, and racism. My guest on this episode, Noah Davis, is a freelance soccer journalist whose work has appeared in such publications as SB Nation, Grantland, and The New Yorker. Last month, Noah wrote about some of the challenges facing the American Outlaws as soccer's popularity and exposure in this country continue to rise. I want to start with the piece you wrote for Fusion in March about the American Outlaws. And my first question about the American Outlaws: are the American Outlaws still good for American soccer?
Yeah, I think they are, definitely. I mean, I think you look at, you know, the example that I always use is I went to both of the last two U.S.-Mexico games in Columbus, the World Cup qualifiers, which is, you know, probably the biggest game in the U.S. every 4 years. And, you know, for the 2010 World Cup cycle, I want to say it was probably 70-30 Mexican U.S. fans in the stands. I mean, there were a lot more Mexican fans than there were U.S. fans. And then that number completely flipped for the 2014 World Cup qualifying cycle. And I think a lot of that is due to the growth of the American Outlaws. You know, they've gone from basically nothing in 2007 to, you know, they have 34,000 members now, which is amazing. And you see that you see the passion so many different places. I think the piece that I wrote, you know, I tried to be positive about that and honest about the growth. I do think that the American Outlaws are good for U.S. soccer. You know, the players talk about having the fans there and they love it, that sort of that 12th man. But I think, you know, the outgrowth of that growth is that there were just some things that they couldn't address with the racism and with the sexism and some of the negative things that were going on. That's, you know, that's going to happen when you have 34,000 people who are following you. You're going to have some bad apples. I think the point of my piece was not that the American Outlaws are bad as an organization, but that there are some things about them that they need to address, and they need to be more proactive with, you know, when some of the racism happens and when some of the sexism happens and when some of these negative things happen. And I think that the steps they've taken, you know, since the piece has come out, whether the piece pushed that or not, I don't know, but with the sort of, you know, with the AO watch that they announced yesterday and the, you know, they have very obviously come out and said, yeah, look, we're going to be more proactive when these things happen. And I think that's great.
So you reference the rivalry between the United States and Mexico, and we're taping this on a Tuesday morning, and tomorrow night in San Antonio, the United States and Mexico square off in a friendly. So there might not be the same fervor amongst the fan bases as there is for a qualifying round, qualifying for the World Cup. But the expectation is that the fans will certainly be into the game. Who knows what the split will be, but it'll be a hotly contested game and crowd. In your piece on the Outlaws in Fusion, you wrote about how there's this kind of battle for the soul of the culture of the American Outlaws, and that there's a small portion, perhaps, of heavy drinking frat boys that do run the risk of changing the tenor and the original spirit of this organization. Are you worried at all about that vibe taking control of the stadium in San Antonio tomorrow night, or have the Outlaws done enough recently to kind of, I would say, lessen some of your concerns?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, you know, when U.S. plays Mexico in San Antonio or in Phoenix or in L.A., I think it's still vastly majority Mexican. So, you know, I think the U.S. fans will be the minority there, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's just an interesting dynamic.
What is the typical split for games that are played in the Southwest?
You know, I think it's probably closer to that sort of 70-30 mark.
Wow,
that I threw
still.
Earlier. Yeah, I don't know how this one will be. I was at the game they played in Arizona.
Right.
I can't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago, and it was, you know, probably 70-30. I mean, you know, 65-35. The thing is, you know, 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, it would have been 90-10. So
really?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think especially in L.A. at the Rose Bowl. And also, you know, it would have been a much more organized. The Mexican support was a lot more organized than the U.S. support. You had sort of had pockets of U.S. support, but just sort of, you know, green El Tri jerseys everywhere. I think that the heavy drinking, you know, party atmosphere, to a certain extent is great. You know, you want that passion and you want the positive cheering. And I don't necessarily think that hard drinking is a negative thing. I mean, there's a lot of people at a lot of different sporting events all over the world who, you know, have a couple pops and then go into the stadium and cheer and everything like that. I think the problem was sort of these pockets of negativity or these pockets of kind of very aggressive, you know, negative sentiment towards the other team or even towards some members of their own group. I think the Outlaws, it's a work in progress. I think before they had started to take the responsibility they had more seriously, I think that they, you know, the four of them in Nebraska had done what they could, and they realized that they needed more help. I think they have continued to push towards that. And I think that, you know, it's not all going to be solved immediately, but I think that the steps that they're taking are certainly positive elements for sure.
U.S. soccer has to be thrilled with the demographics of their fans, because if you look at the numbers and the age groups that are coming out and supporting the United States men's national team, there are a lot of younger guys, and that is the demographic that really drives ratings, that drives advertising, drives sales, all the stuff. That's the key demographic. So in your experience in doing work on the Outlaws and doing work for or on the United States men's national team, what's their response to this growth of the American Outlaws and support for the team? Are they fully behind the Outlaws and kind of this movement, obviously, for increasing popularity of soccer in this country?
I think I wouldn't say they're fully behind it. I mean, I think they're fully behind the growth of soccer in the country and the growth of support and everything like that. I think that they, you know, had some concerns. I think anytime you hear a story about sort of a negative fan experience as U.S. soccer or as the NFL or as the NBA, you know, you have to be concerned about it. I think that would only be natural. I think that the Outlaws, I think that they would think that the Outlaws are net positive. I think the Outlaws are net positive. I think everyone associated with U.S. soccer and soccer in the U.S., I think it's hard to look at the American Outlaws and say that they're not a net positive. That said, I think, you know, there's negative element. And I think that you could look at it and say, well, there are some concerns here, and they need to be addressed. And I think they are being addressed.
What is it about soccer around the world? And I don't know if we can group the support for the United States team in the same category, but when you hear stories about other groups of fans from around the country supporting their team, it seems like too often that support turns into some pretty nasty things as far as nationalism and racism goes. And we hear these awful stories from Europe about how fans treat competitors and fans from other countries and teams. So is this a soccer thing, or is this a supporting your country thing? Where do you think this comes from?
I think it comes from a lot of different places. I mean, I'd say that one of the first things is that you don't hear the positive stories. You know, you only hear the negative stories. Those are the ones that always get played up in the media. So it's not like every support group and every team in every country is racist and horrible and terrible and beating people up. You know, there is certainly a racism problem. There is certainly a sexism problem. There is certainly a hooliganism problem. I think it's less than it used to be in a lot of ways. And I think FIFA is slowly coming around to dealing with it. I think we would all like to see FIFA take a bigger role in stopping, you know, a lot of the negativity and the hooliganism and the racism. I think you've seen some of the players come out and have pretty strong statements against racism, which is, to me, that's sort of the most impressive. And that's where it needs to come from, because FIFA needs to see that their players are not happy with it, and it'll come from there. But, you know, there's a long tradition of hooliganism in soccer, in England, in Eastern Europe, and everywhere. You know, it was accepted for a long time, or at least sort of overlooked. You know, there's a great book called Among the Thugs, where American journalist Bill Buford goes into one of the worst groups in England, the Tottenham fans, I believe, and you know, he sort of embeds there in the 70s, and there's just horrible things happen. You know, they go to Italy and there's a riot and they start it and they'll hit anyone and they'll punch anybody. And so it's sort of this thing. I think the problem for me, and I think for some other people, is that, you know, hooliganism sometimes gets romanticized as just sort of part of soccer culture, and it's really not. I mean, it's really a pretty awful thing. And, you know, it's terrible when the home fans and the away fans, you know, the away fans wait for the home fans to get off the train so they can all fight each other. You know, that's not something that we want in American soccer and American soccer culture. And I think that as we, you know, develop soccer culture in the U.S., it's something that we should strive to keep out of the game, because it's a lot easier to keep it out at the beginning than to let it get in and then have to get rid of it.
You talk about the growth of soccer culture, and soccer culture in this country is clearly growing, but it must be an interesting balance as the sport continues to grow and it appeals to a wider and wider array of people in this country. There are some, as you reference, who go to the games simply for the party-type atmosphere. I mean, that's no different from any other sport. You go to football games and baseball games. It's the same type thing. So in your mind, is perhaps the United States national team or some other organization going to have to step in at some point and kind of mediate between members of the Outlaws and other fans and organizations, or will this just kind of work itself out?
I think it's a little of both. I think that it is working itself out. I think that, like I said before, I think the leaders of American Outlaws are doing a good job to get in front of it, and also doing a good job to empower chapter leaders and other people, you know, in leading roles in the individual chapter communities to get out in front of it as well. You know, look, going to a game and drinking and cheering for the U.S. is fun. It's a pretty fine line between sort of being positive about the U.S. team and about America, and, you know, that's fine, and screaming for the red, white, and blue. And then, you know, there's a slippery slope. And I think that everyone has to be aware that, you know, it's a little bit, there are some things that happen when you root for the U.S. that don't necessarily happen when you root for, you know, the Patriots or the Jets or whatever. I mean, not to say that the Patriots and the Jets don't have some terrible fans as well. And, you know, every major sports team has some, you know, from fans who get into it with the other fans and are just sort of, you know, awful. But I think the nationalism and the patriotism, it's a very fine line between all of that stuff in a way that doesn't happen with just sort of major pro teams. And so I think that adds a little bit of an element to it. But no, you know, I don't know. I'm not as concerned about, you know, the future of the American Outlaws, I think, as I was probably a month or so ago. I think, you know, I think they've taken good steps. I'd like to see them keep doing it. And also I'd like to see that, you know, the reforms and whatnot are enforced. I mean, that's going to be the next question. You know, you mentioned the U.S.-Mexico game. It'll be interesting to kind of hear the tales of that and see how some of that stuff works. You know, it's very early on, so maybe they haven't figured it all out. But as we get into the Gold Cup and stuff like that this summer, you know, to see the U.S., to see the Outlaws, you know, I'd like to see them when the first instance of someone acting inappropriately in a bar towards a woman, when that happens, you know, how is that taken care of? So I think we'll see, but I think that what they've done so far has been good.
Let's talk about the United States and Mexico, because as we've mentioned, they play a friendly tomorrow night in San Antonio, and you've written extensively for SB Nation on the rivalry between these two countries and teams. You know, your story was about how the rivalry really took off starting in 1980. But this game tomorrow night doesn't really have any significance or weight other than pride. Can you tell us why we should care about the actual soccer in tomorrow night's game between the United States and Mexico?
Sure. First of all, pride's a huge thing when it comes to this, right?
You know. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't mean to. I hope you don't get the sense that I'm taking pride away from.
No,
right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, it's not in a competition, so it's not.
But we're not playing for any kind of potential qualifying for any kind of major global tournament or anything,
right,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah, but there is always sort of this back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico, and I think, you know, for dominance in the CONCACAF region, which is the North American region and Central America and the Caribbean, you know, so that matters. That those bragging rights, they do matter. You know, the U.S. is, or Mexico is the U.S.'s biggest rival by far. I think, you know, it's one of the best rivalries in the world. I think, you know, the result, it's important. I think what's more important is that the U.S. has sort of fallen on some hard times. They have, you know, conceded 15 goals in the last 15 minutes of the last 15 games, I think it is. They kind of keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again, and the knives are out for Jurgen Klinsmann in terms of some of the decisions he's made with some of the players and who he's playing and who he's not playing and some of the things he says. It seems like sometimes he says things in the press and doesn't actually really matter. You know, he said in the past that he wants players to be playing for their club, and then he'll only call them into the U.S. national team if they are. But then he does stuff like he calls in Julian Green, who's, you know, a young German American who's not playing at Hamburg in Germany, and does other things along those lines that make sort of, you know, question, what exactly is going on. It's his prerogative. He can do what he wants. He's the national team coach. He knows a lot more about soccer than I do. He knows a lot more about soccer than pretty much everyone in the country. But when you see the team make, you know, concede goals after the 75th minute over and over and over again, and him not really being able to fix it, you start to get concerned. They played Denmark and Switzerland last month, and they were pretty terrible against Denmark and better against Switzerland, although Josie Altidore got a red card. That was a pretty silly red card that hurt them late in the game. But, you know, Switzerland is a good team. They're the 12th ranked team in the world and did well at the World Cup. And to see them, you know, kind of to see the U.S. hold their own against Switzerland, that was the best game they've played since the World Cup, probably. So, you know, stuff to look for tomorrow is just sort of, you know, how they play. Can they hold possession? You know, can they keep the ball against a Mexico team that is good, but it is not, you know, it's not, they're not Brazil, they're not Germany. The U.S. should be able to play pretty much toe-to-toe with Mexico. So that's something to look for. And then again, that last 15 minutes, you know, how does the U.S. do? How does their fitness level look? Can they stay mentally focused for a full 90 minutes?
You mentioned Julian Green. Tomorrow, the United States won't have Dempsey. They won't have Altidore. They won't have, obviously, Tim Howard or some of the other names that we've become familiar with or that have become synonymous with American soccer. So for a lot of fans that are just tuning in because it's the United States-Mexico and haven't really been following the national team these last few months, there are going to be a lot of new faces and names out there. That doesn't mean that all hope is lost, though, for the future of American soccer. Would you say that the talent and the U.S. men's national team pipeline is catching up to the talent of other countries from around the world, or is there still this gap that exists? Because when you watched, at least when I watched the World Cup in Brazil last summer, I noticed some things that were obviously positive signs for the American side, but also there still seemed to be a difference in the overall tempo and speed of the American team compared to some of the other superior clubs from around the world. So I guess the bottom line is, with these new names and faces, are we getting faster?
I think DeAndre Yedlin could probably beat pretty much anyone in the world in a race. You know, just debuted for Tottenham. You know, it's a long process. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I think the easiest answer, most simplest answer, is that the depth of talent in the U.S. is growing. You know, we probably have more better players than the U.S. has ever had before. I think the issue is that the top-end talent is, you know, you're sort of struggling to produce that guy. I mean, I think to say that the U.S. should have produced a Lionel Messi or a Neymar is a little ridiculous, because those are some of the best players. I mean, Messi is one of the best players ever. You know, Neymar is not that close behind him. But, you know, Landon Donovan was probably the best player on the U.S. team for a good decade. And you don't see a guy – there are no other Landon Donovans on the U.S. team now, and there are – and it's unclear if there are guys who are Landon Donovan, you know, even in the pipeline, whether that's with the U-17s or the U-20s, or the U-23. So that's sort of the concern. I mean, I think that, you know, Michael Bradley is a very, very good player. Mix Discarude is, he's a very, very good player who, you know, could make a big difference if he can get a little bit better, a little bit more solid defensively and as a two-way midfielder. You mentioned Tim Howard. He's obviously a wonderful goalkeeper. So is Brad Guzan, who starts for Aston Villa. He won't be there tomorrow. But in terms of the attacking talent, Jesse Zardes, who plays for the LA Galaxy, I think he showed a lot in the Denmark game and the Switzerland game. He's pretty young. We'll see, but you know, he's not a world-class player yet. And that's sort of the difference with the US team is that I always kind of think of this as like the FIFA rankings. I don't know if you've ever played FIFA, but they rank everyone from 1 to 100. And, you know, it's like the US probably has more guys who are between, you know, 72 and 78 or something like that than they've ever had before. But they have very few guys who are, you know, 83, 84, 85, something like, you know, so a little bit higher class.
And that's confusing to me because you would think at this point soccer has reached a level in this country where not to say that the athletes on the pitch tomorrow aren't the best athletes, but where the best of the best athletes in this country are playing more soccer. And that just flat out doesn't seem to be the case. Why in your mind? I mean, this can't be. All I know, fans of the team want to blame Klinsmann for things and maybe some of the decisions he's making as far as who plays, who sits, and some of the technical aspects are on his under his shoulders. But why does there still seem to be this lack of, I don't know if it's fair to say lack of athleticism, but why aren't the best athletes still coming out and playing soccer in this country?
Well, I don't know if it's not that the best athletes aren't coming out and playing soccer. I mean, I think they are, at least some of them. I think the issue, and this is really two parts of the question. I think one of the things that sort of the casual soccer fan doesn't understand is how little the U.S. national team coach has, how little impact the U.S. national team coach has on developing players. You know, at best, Jurgen Klinsmann gets these players for, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks a year. And that's probably too much, especially in a non-World Cup year. You know, it's the development really comes down to the club level. And that means MLS or these guys who are in Europe. That means the European club systems. And, you know, MLS is getting better at developing players. A lot of them have started academies, which follow a protocol that U.S. soccer puts out. Which is a lot more training. It's a lot fewer games. For a while, you know, when a lot of the guys who are playing now are coming up, those academies were focused a lot more on winning. Those club teams were focused more on winning. In a similar way, it's similar to how, some people blame the AAU circuit in basketball for ruining the skills of a lot of players because the AAU teams are so focused on winning so they can get big contracts from Adidas or Nike that they win now and they don't worry about the future. That's changing in the US, I think, a little bit in AAU basketball and also with the MLS academies that are focused on bringing players from the academy to the MLS senior teams. But that takes a long time, you know, it takes this is a silly statement, but it takes 6 years for a guy who is 13 to grow up and to be 19. And so it's just a really slow process. And if you don't get that development right at 13, which it wasn't a decade ago, then when that guy is 23, he's just not going to have the technical ability that someone growing up in Germany would have or something like that. So it takes a long time, to make all that happen. And I think that we're getting to the point where we're starting to see more technical ability, especially in, you know, the 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds. But you need a lot of those guys for one of them to reach his potential.
So I'm glad you mentioned development in the MLS, because one of the things that interests me at least is what is soccer's future for minor leagues and what's the best route for players to take if they want to be eventually emerge as top tier talent in this country and around the world? Is college college soccer a viable alternative for the most talented players in this country if they have dreams of one day reaching the men's national team, of one day reaching some of the top tier leagues in this world? Or is a better system for talent development as you mentioned earlier, some of these academies, some of these quote-unquote minor leagues, perhaps I wouldn't call Major League Soccer a minor league, but something like the NASL, other leagues, smaller leagues in this country that could perhaps produce better talent than college amateur leagues would.
Yeah, I think college right now is still a viable route, but I think each year it gets less and less. The biggest problem is that in college you only play for three seasons, for 3 months, you know, so it's a very short season. They're looking to change that. They're trying to get it so you play longer. I don't know whether that will happen or if it will. I think if it does, college will remain an option. But as the development academies improve and as, you know, like you said, like the NASL and the USL, which is the third tier, as those become more viable options, I think you're going to see more players go there, especially with the MLS development academies. And then also there's a bunch of other development academies that are in the development academy system that are not affiliated with MLS clubs, just because there are, you know, only 20 MLS clubs and 50 states. So there's a lot of development academies. There's a lot of space for other development academies. You know, if I were a 13-year-old kid or a 14-year-old kid who was great at soccer, I would think about going to a development academy rather than going to college. That presents its own problems because you're not getting the college education. So I think college is a viable option. Harrison Shipp, who was one of the plays for the Chicago Fire, who was one of the breakout rookies of last season. You know, he went to college. He spent 4 years at college. A lot of other guys on the U.S. team, Omar Gonzalez went to Maryland. You know, some other guys as well. So it's still an option. I don't think that in the future, you know, 10 years from now, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of guys who spent 4 years at college and then went to MLS or even spent 1 or 2 years at college. You know, you have a bunch of guys who came out now, but I think that's getting less and less prominent.
Is Major League Soccer, you alluded to the quality of Major League Soccer is improving, but is it better than it gets credit for? Because I think sometimes we think of the MLS as an inferior soccer league. Certainly it's not at the level as the EPL or some of the other large leagues and more established leagues in this world. But is the MLS, are we too hard on the MLS right now?
I think yes and no. I mean, look, is every MLS game great? No, you know, but there are a lot of bad EPL games too. I think that the problem with MLS is sort of what you alluded to is I think it has a perception issue. I think sort of the casual American soccer fan, feels it's an inferior league, which is true, but it's not that bad. You know, I think there are some stories that are nice and they're, you know, I think having Fox and ESPN have the Sunday night games has really helped because you just kind of know there's a game on. I found myself watching a lot more MLS this year than I did in the past, because it's just, you know, it's easier to find. I think having guys in the U.S. national team, you know, whether it's Matt Beisler or Omar Gonzalez or Graham Zusi or Kyle Beckerman or Michael Bradley or Josie Altidore, Juan Agudelo, who plays for the Revolution, who's coming back to the team for the first time, Giassi Zardes, who I mentioned earlier. I think as those guys sort of, you know, cement themselves further into the U.S. roster, having them playing in MLS will be a boon for the league. You know, it's kind of fun to watch Toronto FC and watch Bradley and Altidore and watch their connection and see, you know, see how it will help them on the U.S. team when they play together. So no, I mean, is MLS, you know, is it top 5 league in the world? No. Is it top 10 league in the world? You know, I don't know, maybe you could make a case for it somewhere, you know, 9 through 12, something like that. But I think the biggest issue is that, you know, if you watch an EPL game and someone makes a bad pass, you think, oh man, you know, it must have been, the ball must have skipped off the turf or, you know, something like that. You watch an MLS game and the guy makes a bad pass, you think, oh, that guy sucks, you know? and I think that's the issue they're facing. And I'm not sure what the solution to that problem is, but, you know, MLS, it gets better every year by, I don't know, 5%, 10%, something like that, you know, in terms of quality and professionalism and all kinds of stuff like that. And I don't think you can say that about any of the big leagues in the world, you know, whether it's the EPL, Bundesliga, La Liga, you know, you look at Serie A, which used to be the biggest league in the world, and now it's garbage because it's all these betting scandals and the money didn't work out and you have teams hemorrhaging money. And so I think MLS is, you know, I think it's here to stay, which is something that you probably wouldn't have said 10 years ago definitively. I think it's going to keep getting better. I think the players will come. You know, you're starting to see teams be smarter about signing designated players who, you know, may not make sort of the impact at the box office, the ticket office that the team is hoping for, but will make an impact on the field. And, you know, it turns out that, like any sport, winning is the thing that draws your fans in a lot of ways. And teams are figuring that out, and they're getting better at figuring out how to win and how to, you know, negotiate the salary cap. And the owners are getting, you know, every time a new owner comes in, they want to spend more money than the previous owners. And that's a good thing for the league.
The league seems to be doing well financially because there's a lot of expansion going on. And I know the New York City Football Club and Orlando City are two teams that entered the league this year and are, I don't know if they're how well they're doing on the field, but I think they're drawing fairly well. Certainly you hear some good stories about what's going on in Orlando, but I'm still curious as to whether or not there's going to be cohesion between the MLS and the men's national team, because there was all that, I don't know when the controversy was, but Jurgen Klinsmann came out and said, you know, I don't know what exactly he said, but there was tension between Klinsmann and the MLS because I'm pretty sure Klinsmann alluded to the fact that he'd like his players to be playing in leagues that are better than the MLS. Is that right?
He said things like that. Klinsmann's thing is that he wants players to challenge themselves. And he is, I think he's been disappointed that a guy like Michael Bradley, who's, you know, the midfield engine for the U.S. national team, came back to Toronto FC. But, you know, he's been positive about the move that Jozy Altidore made to come back to Toronto FC because he wasn't getting any time in the EPL. Klinsmann has also been upset about the fitness of some MLS players, which, you know, I don't know. It seems kind of ridiculous to me. He called out a couple guys from Sporting Kansas City for not being fit. You know, the Sporting Kansas City is the most fit team in MLS, and Klinsmann sort of was upset that they were not fit in January when they had the January camp, which was at the end of the season, and the players took a couple weeks off because, you know, any normal person would want to take a couple weeks off. And I think the Klinsmann MLS battle is, you know, it's on a low simmer. I think it will probably continue to flare up at various points. Klinsmann is going to say what he's going to say, and he has his opinions, and he thinks his opinions are right. You know, I don't necessarily think that his opinions are wrong. I think some of them are accurate, some of them are a little bit less so. And I think he's right about the culture of the U.S. team needed to change a little bit more and needed to get a little bit tougher and a little bit more competitive. Which is happening both through Klinsmann's words and also just sort of what I talked about earlier, which is, you know, as the depth of the team gets better, instead of having one or two guys fighting for a spot, suddenly you have three or four guys fighting for that starting spot. And so naturally the competition increases. And that will push the players too. You know, it's easy to let yourself slide a little bit. If you're the best right back in the entire country and everybody knows it, you have to be pretty self-motivated to keep pushing. And, you know, it's easy to sometimes take a break. If you have, you know, two or three guys breathing down your neck for that spot, it's a lot easier to kind of get out and do that extra work. So I think the competition will, you know, create itself a little bit as well.
Last question for you and regarding competition. This summer's Women's World Cup promises to be very entertaining in Canada. Care to make any predictions as far as how far the United States women's team goes?
Yeah. No, it's kind of interesting. That women's team, it's such an enigma right now. I mean, they have, you know, great talent with Alex Morgan and Abby Wambach and, you know, sort of the old talent, and Hope Solo is the best goalkeeper in the world. You know, I think by a pretty wide margin. And you have some good young talent, you know, Jenny Johnson and Christian Press, and you have a lot of attacking pieces, you know, and Sidney LaRue as well. I'm not sure that they all fit, and I think that's Jill Ellis's biggest issue right now, is sort of where to play people and what style to play. And you know, you've seen this coming with the U.S. women's team for a while now. They've had good luck at the Olympics. They haven't had good luck at the Women's World Cup, and they haven't won since '99, which I think would shock anyone who, you know, sort of thinks as the U.S. women is this dominant force. And they
wow, win. that is shocking. That
yeah,
seems,
it's amazing.
That
right?
doesn't seem right. I would have thought that they would have won since then.
Yeah, no, they haven't. And which is very surprising.
Yes.
You know, they had that great run 4 years ago and lost to Japan. But it's, you know, this team sort of – I kind of liken them to – they were like this very large corporation that was just dominating everything, almost like Microsoft or something like that. And they just sort of – because of that, they got a little complacent, you know, not so much the players, I think, but sort of the coaching staff at various points and the development system, there wasn't as much of a need to do all of that. And so they sort of lost their edge technically on the rest of the world. And, you know, as countries like Germany and Brazil and France and Sweden started putting more resources into women's soccer, they all caught up pretty quickly because they already had this sort of tradition of development on the men's side. And so they could implement those strategies. And the U.S. is, they're not trying to play catch up, but they're at the point where they're trying to get up to, you know, running as fast as the rest of these countries are, and they're struggling. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I mean, I think I'm positive. You know, I'd like to stay positive about the team. I think they're in a better place than they were last summer in terms of trying to integrate some of the new talent with some of the older talent. But you know, they're in a very tough group. And if they don't win the group, they're going to have a very tough second round match. And it gets pretty tough if they don't win the group. So, you know, I don't know. I think playing in Canada is going to help them a lot, just being close to home. I think they'll have pretty good support. I know, you know, the Outlaws are doing a pretty good job of planning for that. And it'll be, they'll have that, which I think will help a lot. You know, honestly, they could go out in the quarterfinals. They could win the whole thing, and I don't think either of those would really surprise me.
Well, hopefully the U.S. women's national team is listening, and they are going to be inspired by your pessimism, Noah.
Always, exactly.
Noah, care to weigh in at all on the Champions League quarterfinals starting this week?
Champions League, I think the most fun matchup. I mean, it's fun when you get to the final eight, obviously the quarterfinals. I think, you know, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that could be great or it could be terrible. I mean, these teams, they're so familiar with each other. They've played, you know, 11 times in the last 17 months. And Atletico is, they haven't lost in the last six matches against Real Madrid, which is pretty impressive. I mean, they sort of have Real Madrid's number in that way that, you know, teams do. Real Madrid is playing a lot better than they were when they last met. And, you know, I think Cristiano Ronaldo, he's a jerk, but he's fun to watch, man. And, that Real Madrid team, when they're playing well, it is a lot of fun to watch in sort of the attacking soccer they play. You know, I think Juventus Monaco, I think Juventus is probably going to win that one pretty easily. The Monaco run is going to end. Juventus is chasing the treble, and they're pretty far ahead in Serie A, so they can focus a little bit more on the Champions League. I mean, that's the thing. When you get to this late stage, some of the teams have trouble because they're battling away in their domestic competition, and that's really important. Like Monaco is fighting for a top three spot in the French league. You know, it makes it tough because you sort of have to decide what you want to prioritize, whether you want the domestic league or, you know, Champions League. And I think Juventus being so far ahead in Serie A gives them a lot of flexibility in terms of being able to, you know, pick their best for the Champions League. I think Bayern Munich is going to, you know, win pretty easily against Porto, although Byron has a lot of players out. Robin's out. Schweinsteiger's out. Ribery is out. But, you know, Byron has sort of unlimited number of players they can plug in there. And Pep Guardiola is a good enough coach to be able to figure it all out. Yeah, PSG, Barca, it would have been a lot more fun if Zlatan was going to be there. But again, you know, like Real Madrid, I think Barcelona is, they're fun enough to watch on their own, that it kind of doesn't matter who they're playing, and especially in a big setting like this. So I'd like to think that that game will have some flair to it, but PSG has so many guys out, with, you know, Ibrahimovic suspended and Mata and David Luiz injured. And how well Barca is playing right now, it's hard to see PSG being able to hang.
Well, Noah Davis, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Of course, anytime.